"I will," he said. She had not seemed to know I was there, but now her eyes found me, and her nose wrinkled, as if at a rising stench. She looked back to him.
"He is not worthy of you," she said. "He has never been."
"We disagree on this," Achilles answered. He said it as if he had said it many times before. Probably he had. She made a low noise of contempt, then vanished. Achilles turned to me.
"She is afraid."
"I know," I said. I cleared my throat, trying to release the clot of dread that had formed there.
"Who is the best of the Myrmidons, do you think, if I am excluded?"
I cast my mind through our captains. I thought of Automedon, who had become Achilles' valuable second on the battlefield, but I would not call him best. "I don't know," I said.
"Do you think it means my father?" he asked.
Peleus, home in Thyre, who had fought with Heracles and Perseus, a legend in his own time for piety and courage, even if not in times to come.
"Maybe," I admitted.
We were silent a moment. Then he said,
"I suppose we'll know soon enough."
"It is not you," I said. "At least there is that." That afternoon we performed the sacrifice his mother had commanded. The Myrmidons built the altar fires high, and I held bowls for the blood while Achilles cut throat after throat. We burned the rich thigh pieces with barley and pomegranate, poured our best wine over the coals. "Apollo is angry," she had said. "One of our most powerful gods, with his arrows that could stop a man's heart, swift as rays of sun. I was not known for my piety, but that day I praised Apollo with an intensity that could have rivaled Peleus himself. And whoever the best of the Myrmidons was, I sent the gods a prayer for him as well." Briseis asked me to teach her medicine and promised in return a knowledge of the area's herbs, indispensable to Machaon's dwindling supply. I agreed and passed many contented days with her in the forest, parting low-hanging branches, reaching underneath rotting logs for mushrooms as delicate and soft as the ear of a baby. Sometimes, on those days, her hand would accidentally brush mine, and she would look up and smile, water drops hanging from her ears and hair like pearls. Her long skirt was tied practically around her knees, revealing feet that were sturdy and sure. One of these days, we had stopped for lunch. We feasted on cloth-wrapped bread and cheese, strips of dried meat, and water scooped with our hands from the stream. It was spring, and we were surrounded by the profusion of Anatolian fertility. For 3 weeks the earth would paint herself in every color, burst every bud, unfurl each rioting petal. Then, the wild flush of her excitement spent, she would settle down to the steady work of summer. It was my favorite time of year. I should have seen it coming. Perhaps you will think me stupid that I did not. I was telling her a story, something about Chiron, I think, and she was listening, her eyes dark like the earth on which we sat. I finished, and she was quiet. This was nothing unusual, she was often quiet. We were sitting close to each other, heads together as if in conspiracy. I could smell the fruit she had eaten. I could smell the rose oil she pressed for the other girls, still staining her fingers. She was so dear to me, I thought. Her serious face and clever eyes. I imagined her as a girl, scraped with tree climbing, skinny limbs flying as she ran. I wished that I had known her then, that she had been with me at my father's house, had skipped stones with my mother. Almost I could imagine her there, hovering just at the edge of my remembrance. Her lips touched mine. I was so surprised I did not move. Her mouth was soft and a little hesitant. Her eyes were sweetly closed. Of habit, of its own accord, my mouth parted. A moment passed like this, the ground beneath us, the breeze sifting flower scents. Then she drew back, eyes down, waiting for judgment. My pulse sounded in my ears, but it was not as Achilles made it sound. It was something more like surprise and fear that I would hurt her. I put my hand to hers. She knew then. She felt it in the way I took her hand, the way my gaze rested on her.
"I'm sorry," she whispered.
I shook my head, but could not think of what more to say. Her shoulders crept up like folded wings.
"I know that you love him," she said,
hesitating a little before each word.
"I know. But I thought that some men have wives and lovers both."
Her face looked very small and so sad that I could not be silent.
"Briseis," I said, "if I ever wished to take a wife, it would be you."
"But you do not wish to take a wife."
"No,"
I said, as gently as I could. She nodded, and her eyes dropped again. I could hear her slow breaths, the faint tremor in her chest.
"I'm sorry," I said.
"Do you not ever want children?" she asked.
The question surprised me. I still felt half a child myself, though most my age were parents several times over.
"I don't think I would be much of a parent," I said.
"I do not believe that," she said.
"I don't know," I said. "Do you?" I asked it casually, but it seemed to strike deep, and she hesitated.
"Maybe,"
she said. And then I understood, too late, what she had really been asking me. I flushed, embarrassed at my thoughtlessness. And humbled, too. I opened my mouth to say something, to thank her, perhaps. But she was already standing, brushing off her dress.
"Shall we go?"
There was nothing to do but rise and join her. That night, I could not stop thinking of it. Briseis's and my child. I saw stumbling legs and dark hair and the mother's big eyes. I saw us by the fire, Briseis and I and the baby, playing with some bit of wood I had carved. Yet there was an emptiness to the scene, an ache of absence. Where was Achilles? Dead? Or had he never existed? I could not live in such a life. But Briseis had not asked me to. She had offered me all of it, herself and the child and Achilles too. I shifted to face Achilles.
"Did you ever think of having children?" I asked.
His eyes were closed, but he was not sleeping.
"I have a child," he answered.
It shocked me anew each time I remembered it. His child with Deidamia. A boy, Thetis had told him, called Neoptolemus. New war, nicknamed Pyrrhus for his fiery red hair. It disturbed me to think of him, a piece of Achilles wandering through the world. "Does he look like you?" I had asked Achilles once. Achilles had shrugged.
"I didn't ask."
"Do you wish you could see him?" Achilles shook his head.
"It is best that my mother raise him. He will be better with her."
I did not agree. But this was not the time to say so. I waited a moment for him to ask me if I wished to have a child. But he did not, and his breathing grew more even. He always fell asleep before I did.
"Achilles."
"Hm?"
"Do you like Briseis?"
He frowned, his eyes still closed.
"Like her?"
"Enjoy her," I said. "You know." His eyes opened. More alert than I had expected.
"What does this have to do with children?"
"Nothing." But I was obviously lying.
"Does she wish to have a child?"
"Maybe," I said.
"With me?"
he said. "No," I said.
"That is good,"
he said, eyelids drooping once more. Moments passed and I was sure he was asleep, but then he said,
"With you. She wants to have a child with you."
My silence was his answer. He sat up, the blanket falling from his chest.
"Is she pregnant?" he asked.
There was a tautness to his voice I had not heard before.
"No,"
I said. His eyes dug into mine, sifting them for answers.
"Do you want to?"
he asked. I saw the struggle on his face. Jealousy was strange to him, a foreign thing. He was hurt, but did not know how to speak of it. I felt cruel suddenly for bringing it up.
No, I said, I don't think so. No.
If you wanted it, it would be all right.
Each word was carefully placed. He was trying to be fair. I thought of the dark-haired child again. I thought of Achilles. It is all right now, I said. The relief on his face filled me with sweetness. Things were strange for some time after that. Briseis would have avoided me, but I called on her as I used to, and we went for our walks as we always had. We talked of camp gossip and medicine. She did not mention wives, and I was careful not to mention children. I still saw the softness in her eyes when she looked at me. I did my best to return it as I could. Chapter 25. One day, in the ninth year, a girl mounted the dais. There was a bruise on her cheek, spreading like spilled wine down the side of her face. Ribbons fluttered from her hair, ceremonial fillets that marked her as servant to a god. A priest's daughter, I heard someone say. Achilles and I exchanged a glance. She was beautiful, despite her terror. Large hazel eyes set in a round face, soft chestnut hair loose around her ears. A slender, girlish frame. As we watched, her eyes filled, dark pools that brimmed their banks spilling down her cheeks, falling from her chin to the ground. She did not wipe them away. Her hands were tied behind her back. As the men gathered, her eyes lifted, seeking the sky in mute prayer. I nudged Achilles and he nodded, but before he could claim her, Agamemnon stepped forward. He rested one hand on her slight, bowed shoulder.
"This is Chryseis," he said, "and I take her for myself."
Then he pulled her from the dais, leading her roughly to his tent. I saw the priest, Calchas, frowning, his mouth half open as if he might object, but then he closed it, and Odysseus finished the distribution. It was barely a month after that the girl's father came, walking down the beach with a staff of gold-studded wood, threaded with garlands. He wore his beard long in the style of Anatolian priests, his hair unbound but decorated with bits of ribbon to match his staff. His robe was banded with red and gold, loose with fabric that billowed and flapped around his legs. Behind him, silent under-priests strained to heft the weight of huge wooden chests. He did not slow for their faltering steps but strode relentlessly onwards. The small procession moved past the tents of Ajax and Diomedes and Nestor, closest to the Agora, and then on to the dais itself. By the time Achilles and I had heard and run, weaving around slower soldiers, he had planted himself there, staff strong. When Agamemnon and Menelaus mounted the dais to approach him, he did not acknowledge them, only stood there, proud, before his treasure and the heaving chests of his underlings. Agamemnon glowered at the presumption but held his tongue. Finally, when enough soldiers had gathered, drawn from every corner by breathless rumour, he turned to survey them all, his eyes moving across the crowd, taking in kings and common. Landing at last on the twin sons of Atreus who stood before him. He spoke in a voice resonant and grave, made for leading prayers. He gave his name, Chryseis, and identified himself, staff raised, as a high priest of Apollo. Then he pointed to the chests, open now to show gold and gems and bronze catching the sun.
"None of this tells us why you have come, priest Chryseis."
Menelaus's voice was even, but with an edge of impatience. Trojans did not climb the dais of the Greek kings and make speeches.
"I have come to ransom my daughter, Chryseis," he said, "taken unlawfully by the Greek army from our temple. A slight girl and young, with fillets in her hair."
The Greeks muttered. Suppliants seeking ransom knelt and begged. They did not speak like kings giving sentence in court. Yet he was a high priest, not used to bending to anyone but his god, and allowances could be made. The gold he offered was generous, twice what the girl was worth, and a priest's favour was never something to scorn. That word, unlawful, had been sharp as a drawn sword, but we could not say that he was wrong to use it. Even Diomedes and Odysseus were nodding, and Menelaus drew a breath as if to speak. But Agamemnon stepped forward, broad as a bear, his neck muscles twisting in anger.
"Is this how a man begs? You are lucky I do not kill you where you stand. I am this army's commander," he spat, "and you have no leave to speak before my men. Here is your answer. No, there will be no ransom. She is my prize, and I will not give her up now or ever. Not for this trash or any other you can bring."
His fingers clenched, only inches from the priest's throat.
"You will depart now, and let me not ever catch you in my camps again, priest, or even your garlands will not save you."
Chryses' jaw was clamped down on itself, though whether from fear or biting back a reply we could not tell. His eyes burned with bitterness. Sharply, without a word, he turned and stepped from the dais and strode back up the beach. Behind him trailed his underpriests with their clinking boxes of treasure. Even after Agamemnon left and the men had exploded into gossip around me, I watched the Shames priest's distant, retreating figure. Those at the end of the beach said that he was crying out and shaking his staff at the sky. That night, slipping among us like a snake, quick and silent and flickering, the plague began. When we woke the next morning, we saw the mules drooping against their fences, breaths shallow and bubbling with yellow mucus, eyes rolling. Then by midday it was the dogs, whining and snapping at the air, tongues foaming a red-tinged scum. By the late afternoon, every one of these beasts was dead or dying, shuddering on the ground in pools of bloody vomit. Machaon and I, and Achilles too, burned them as fast as they fell, ridding the camp of their bile-soaked bodies, their bones that rattled as we tossed them onto the pyres. When we went back to the camp that night, Achilles and I scrubbed ourselves in the harsh salt of the sea, then with clean water from the stream in the forest. We did not use the Simois or the Scamander, the big, meandering Trojan rivers that the other men washed in and drank from. In bed later, we speculated in hushed whispers, unable to help but listen for the hitch in our own breath, the gathering of mucus in our throats. But we heard nothing except our voices repeating the remedies Chiron had taught us like murmured prayers. The next morning, it was the men. Dozens pierced with illness, crumpling where they stood, their eyes bulging and wet, lips cracking open and bleeding fine red threads down their chins. Machaon and Achilles and Podalerius and I, and even eventually Briseis, ran to drag away each newly dropped man, downed as suddenly as if by a spear or arrow. At the edge of the camp, a field of sick men bloomed, 10 and 20 and then 50 of them, shuddering, calling for water, tearing off their clothes for respite from the fire they claimed raged in them. Finally, in the later hours their skin broke apart, macerating like holes in a worn blanket, shredding to pus and pulpy blood. At last, their violent trembling ceased, and they lay puddling in the swamp of their final torrent, the dark emptying of their bowels, clotted with blood. Achilles and I built pyre after pyre, burning every scrap of wood we could find. Finally, we abandoned dignity and ritual for necessity, throwing onto each fire not one, but a heap of bodies. We did not even have time to stand watch over them as their flesh and bone mingled and melted together. Eventually, most of the kings joined us. Menelaus first, then Ajax, who split whole trees with a single stroke, fuel for fire after fire. As we worked, Diomedes went among the men and discovered the few who still lay concealed in their tents, shaking with fever and vomit, hidden by their friends who did not want yet to send them to the death grounds. Agamemnon did not leave his tent. Another day then, and another, and every company, every king had lost dozens of soldiers. although strangely, Achilles and I noted, our hands pulling closed eyelid after eyelid, none of them were kings, only minor nobles and foot soldiers. None of them were women, this too we noticed. Our eyes found each other's, full of suspicions that grew as men dropped suddenly with a cry, hands clutching their chests where the plague had struck them, like the quick shaft of an arrow. It was the ninth night of this, of corpses and burning, and our faces streaked with pus. We stood in our tent gasping with exhaustion, stripping off the tunics we had worn, throwing them aside for the fire. Our suspicions tumbled out, confirmed in a thousand ways that this was not a natural plague, not the creeping spread of haphazard disease. It was something else, sudden and cataclysmic, as the snuffing of Aulis's winds, a god's displeasure. We remembered Chryses and his righteous outrage at Agamemnon's blasphemy, his disregard for the codes of war and fair ransom. And we remembered, too, which god he served, the divinity of light and medicine and plague. Achilles slipped out of the tent when the moon was high. He came back some time later, smelling of the sea. "What does she say?" I asked, sitting up in bed.
"She says we are right."
On the tenth day of the plague, with the Myrmidons at our backs, we strode up the beach to the Agora. Achilles mounted the dais and cupped his hands to help his voice carry. Shouting over the roar of pyres and the weeping of women and the groans of the dying, he called for every man in camp to gather. Slowly, fearfully, men staggered forward, blinking in the sun. They looked pale and hunted, fearful of the plague arrows that sank in chests like stones into water, spreading their rot as ripples in a pond. Achilles watched them come, armor buckled around him, sword strapped to his side, his hair gleaming like water poured over bright bronze. It was not forbidden for someone other than the general to call a meeting, but it had never been done in our 10 years at Troy. Agamemnon shouldered through the crowd with his Mycenaeans to mount the dais.
"What is this?"
he demanded. Achilles greeted him politely.
"I have gathered the men to speak of the plague. Do I have your leave to address them?"
Agamemnon's shoulders were hunched forward with shame-sprung rage. He should have called this meeting himself long ago, and he knew it. He could hardly rebuke Achilles for doing it now, especially not with the men watching. The contrast between the two had never seemed more sharp. Achilles, relaxed and in control with an ease that denied the funeral pyres and sunken cheeks. Agamemnon, with his face tight as a miser's fist, lowering over us all. Achilles waited until the men had assembled, kings and common both. Then he stepped forward and smiled.
"Kings," he said. "Lords, men of the Greek kingdoms, how can we fight a war when we are dying of plague? It's time, past time, that we learn what we have done to deserve a god's anger."
Swift whispers and murmurs. Men had suspected the gods. Was not all great evil and good sent from their hands? But to hear Achilles say so openly was a relief. His mother was a goddess, and he would know. Agamemnon's lips were pulled back to show his teeth. He stood too close to Achilles, as if he would crowd him off the dais. Achilles did not seem to notice.
"We have a priest here, among us, a man close to the gods. Should we not ask him to speak?"
A hopeful ripple of assent went through the men. I could hear the creaking of metal, Agamemnon's grip on his own wrist, the slow strangle of his buckled gauntlet. Achilles turned to the king.
"Is this not what you recommended to me, Agamemnon?"
Agamemnon's eyes narrowed. He did not trust generosity. He did not trust anything. He stared at Achilles a moment, waiting for the trap. At last, ungratefully, he said,
"Yes, I did."
He gestured roughly to his Mycenaeans.
"Bring me Calchas."
They towed the priest forward out of the crowd. He was uglier than ever, with his beard that never quite filled in, his hair scraggly and rank with sour sweat. He had a habit of darting his tongue across cracked lips before he spoke.
"High King and Prince Achilles, you catch me unprepared. I did not think that..."
Those freakish blue eyes flickered between the two men.
"That is, I did not expect I would be asked to speak here before so many."
His voice wheedled and ducked, like a weasel escaping the nest.
"Speak," Agamemnon commanded.
Calchas seemed at a loss. His tongue swiped his lips again and again. Achilles' clear voice prompted him.
"You have done sacrifices, surely. You have prayed?"
"I have, of course I have, but..."
The priest's voice trembled.
"I am afraid that what I might say might anger someone here. Someone who is powerful and does not forget insult easily."
Achilles squatted to reach a hand out to the grimed shoulder of the flinching priest, clasping it genially.
"Calchas, we are dying. This is not the time for such fears. What man among us would hold your words against you? I would not, even if you named me as the cause. Would any of you?"
He looked at the men before him. They shook their heads.
"You see, no sane man would ever harm a priest."
Agamemnon's neck went taut as ship ropes. I was suddenly aware of how strange it was to see him standing alone. Always his brother, or Odysseus, or Diomedes was near him. But those men waited on the side, with the rest of the princes. Calchas cleared his throat.
"The auguries have shown that it is the god Apollo who is angry."
Apollo. The name went through the host like wind in summer wheat. Calchas's eyes flickered to Agamemnon, then back to Achilles. He swallowed.
"He is offended, it seems, so the omens say, at the treatment of his dedicated servant, Chryses."
Agamemnon's shoulders were rigid. Calchas stumbled on.
"To appease him, the girl Chryses must be returned without ransom, and High King Agamemnon must offer prayers and sacrifices."
He stopped, his last word gulped down suddenly as if he had run out of air. Agamemnon's face had broken into dark red blotches of shock. It seemed like the greatest arrogance or stupidity not to have guessed he might be at fault, but he had not. The silence was so profound, I felt I could hear the grains of sand falling against each other at our feet.
"Thank you, Calchas,"
Agamemnon said, his voice splintering the air.
"Thank you for always bringing good news. Last time it was my daughter. Kill her, you said, because you have angered the goddess. Now you seek to humiliate me before my army."
He wheeled on the men, his face twisted in rage.
"Am I not your general? And do I not see you fed and clothed and honored? And are my Mycenaeans not the largest part of this army? The girl is mine, given to me as a prize, and I will not give her up. Have you forgotten who I am?"
He paused, as if he hoped the men might shout, "No, no," but none did.
"King Agamemnon,"
Achilles stepped forward. His voice was easy, almost amused.
"I don't think anyone has forgotten that you are leader of this host, but you do not seem to remember that we are kings in our own right, or princes, or heads of our families. We are allies, not slaves."
A few men nodded. More would have liked to.
"Now, while we die, you complain about the loss of a girl you should have ransomed long ago? You say nothing of the lives you have taken, or the plague you have started."
Agamemnon made an inarticulate noise, his face purple with rage. Achilles held up a hand.
"I do not mean to dishonor you. I only wish to end the plague. Send the girl to her father and be done."
Agamemnon's cheeks were creased with fury.
"I understand you, Achilles. You think because you're the son of a sea nymph, you have the right to play high prince wherever you go. You have never learned your place among men."
Achilles opened his mouth to answer.
"You will be silent,"
Agamemnon said, words lashing like a whip.
You will not speak another word, or you will be sorry.
Or I will be sorry.
Achilles' face was very still. The words were quiet but distinctly audible.
I do not think, High King, that you can afford to say such things to me.
Do you threaten me? Agamemnon shouted. Did you not hear him threaten me?
It is not a threat. What is your army without me?
Agamemnon's face was clotted with malice.
You have always thought too much of yourself, he sneered. We should have left you where we found you, hiding behind your mother's skirts, in a skirt yourself.
The men frowned in confusion, whispered to each other. Achilles' hands were fisted at his sides. He hung on to his composure, barely.
You say this to turn attention away from yourself. If I had not called this council, how long would you have let your men die? Can you answer that?
Agamemnon was already roaring over him.
When all of these brave men came to Aulis, they knelt to offer me their loyalty. All of them but you. I think we have indulged your arrogance long enough. It is time, past time, he mimicked Achilles, that you swore the oath.
I do not need to prove myself to you, to any of you.
Achilles' voice was cold.
His chin lifted in disdain. I am here of my own free will, and you are lucky that it is so. I am not the one who should kneel.
It was too far. I felt the men shift around me. Agamemnon seized upon it, like a bird bolting a fish.
Do you hear his pride? He turned to Achilles. You will not kneel.
Achilles' face was like stone.
I will not.
Then you are a traitor to this army, and will be punished like one. Your war prize is a hostage, placed in my care until you offer your obedience and submission. Let us start with that girl. Briseis is her name? She will do as penance for the girl you have forced me to return.
The air died in my lungs.
She is mine, Achilles said.
Each word fell sharp like a butcher cutting meat.
Given to me by all the Greeks. You cannot take her. If you try, your life is forfeit. Think on that, king, before you bring harm to yourself.
Agamemnon's answer came quickly. He could never back down in front of a crowd. Never.
I do not fear you. I will have her.
He turned to his Mycenaeans.
Bring the girl.
Around me were the shocked faces of kings. Briseis was a war prize, a living embodiment of Achilles' honor. In taking her, Agamemnon denied Achilles the full measure of his worth. The men muttered, and I hoped they might object, but no one spoke. Because he was turned, Agamemnon did not see Achilles' hand go to his sword. My breath caught. I knew that he was capable of this, a single thrust through Agamemnon's cowardly heart. I saw the struggle on his face. I still do not know why he stopped himself. Perhaps he wanted greater punishment for the king than death.
Agamemnon, he said.
I flinched from the roughness of his voice. The king turned, and Achilles drove a finger into his chest. The High King could not stop the huff of surprise.
Your words today have caused your own death and the death of your men. I will fight for you no longer. Without me, your army will fall. Hector will grind you to bones and bloody dust, and I will watch it and laugh. You will come, crying for mercy, but I will give none. They will all die, Agamemnon, for what you have done here.
He spat, a huge wet smack between Agamemnon's feet. And then he was before me, and past me, and I was dizzied, and I turned to follow him, feeling the Myrmidons behind me. Hundreds of men shouldering their way through the crowd, storming off to their tents. Powerful strides took him swiftly up the beach. His anger was incandescent, a fire under his skin. His muscles were pulled so taut I was afraid to touch him, fearing they would snap like bowstrings. He did not stop once we reached the camp. He did not turn and speak to the men. He seized the extra tent flap covering our door and ripped it free as he passed. His mouth was twisted, ugly and tight as I had ever seen it. His eyes were wild.
I will kill him, he swore. I will kill him.
He grabbed a spear and broke it in half with an explosion of wood. The pieces fell to the floor.
"I almost did it there," he said. "I should have done it. How dare he?"
He flung a ewer aside and it shattered against a chair.
"The cowards! You saw how they bit their lips and did not dare to speak. I hope he takes all their prizes. I hope he swallows them one by one."
A voice, tentative, outside. "Achilles?"
"Come in,"
Achilles snarled. Automedon was breathless and stuttering. "I am sorry to disturb you. Phoenix told me to stay, so I could listen and tell you what happened."
"And?"
Achilles demanded. Automedon flinched. "Agamemnon asked why Hector still lived. He said that they do not need you, that perhaps you are not what you say you are." Another spear shaft shattered in Achilles' fingers. Automedon swallowed. "They are coming now. For Briseis." Achilles had his back to me. I could not see his face.
"Leave us,"
he told his charioteer. Automedon backed away, and we were alone. They were coming for Briseis. I stood, my hands balled. I felt strong, unbending, like my feet pierced through the earth to the other side of the world. "We must do something," I said. "We can hide her, in the woods, or..."
"He will pay now," Achilles said.
There was fierce triumph in his voice.
"Let him come for her. He has doomed himself."
"What do you mean?"
"I must speak to my mother."
He started from the tent. I seized his arm. "We don't have time. They will have taken her by the time you are back. We must do something now." He turned. His eyes looked strange, the pupils huge and dark, swallowing his face. He seemed to be looking a long way off.
"What are you talking about?"
I stared at him.
"Briseis!"
He stared back. I could not follow the flicker of emotion in his eyes.
"I can do nothing for her," he said at last. "If Agamemnon chooses this path, he must bear the consequences."
A feeling, as if I were falling into ocean depths weighted with stones. "You're not going to let him take her." He turned away. He would not look at me.
"It is his choice. I told him what would happen if he did. You know what he will do to her." "It is his choice," he repeated. "He would deprive me of my honor. He would punish me. I will let him."
His eyes were lit with an inner fire. "You will not help her."
"There is nothing I can do,"
he said with finality. A tilting vertigo, as if I were drunk. I could not speak or think. I had never been angry with him before. I did not know how.
"She is one of us. How can you just let him take her? Where is your honor? How can you let him defile her?"
And then suddenly, I understood. Nausea seized me. I turned to the door.
"Where are you going?"
he asked. My voice was scraped and savage. "I have to warn her. She has a right to know what you have chosen." I stand outside her tent. It is small, brown with hides, set back.
"Briseis,"
I hear myself say.
"Come in."
Her voice is warm and pleased. We have had no time to speak during the plague, beyond necessities. Inside she is seated on a stool, mortar and pestle in her lap. The air smells sharply of nutmeg. She is smiling. I feel wrung dry with grief. How can I tell her what I know? I try to speak. Stop. She sees my face, and her smile vanishes. Swiftly, she is on her feet and by my side.
"What is it?"
She presses the cool skin of her wrist to my forehead.
"Are you ill? Is Achilles all right?"
I am sick with shame, but there is no space for my self-pity. They are coming.
"Something has happened,"
I say. My tongue thickens in my mouth. My words do not come out straight. "Achilles went today to speak to the men. The plague is Apollo's."
"We thought so,"
she nods, her hand resting gently on mine in comfort. I almost cannot go on.
"Agamemnon did not... He was angry. He and Achilles quarreled.
Agamemnon wants to punish him.
Punish him? How?
Now she sees something in my eyes. Her face goes quiet, pulling into itself, bracing.
What is it?
He is sending men. For you. I see the flare of panic, though she tries to hide it. Her fingers tighten on mine.
What will happen?
My shame is caustic, searing every nerve. It is like a nightmare. I expect each moment to wake to relief, but there is no waking. It is true. He will not help. He? I cannot say more. It is enough. She knows. Her right hand clutches at her dress, chapped and raw from the rough work of the past 9 days. I force out stuttering words meant to be a comfort, of how we will get her back, of how it will be all right. Lies, all of it. We both know what will happen to her in Agamemnon's tent. Achilles knows too, and sends her anyway. My mind is filled with cataclysm and apocalypse. I wish for earthquakes, eruptions, flood. Only that seems large enough to hold all of my rage and grief. I want the world overturned like a bowl of eggs, smashed at my feet. A trumpet blows outside. Her hand goes to her cheek, swipes away tears.
Go, she whispers. Please.
Chapter 26. In the distance, two men are walking towards us up the long stretch of beach, wearing the bright purple of Agamemnon's camp, stamped with the symbol of heralds. I know them, Talthybius and Eurybates, Agamemnon's chief messengers, honored as men of discretion close to the High King's ear. Hate knots my throat. I want them dead. They are close now, passing the glaring Myrmidon guards who rattle their armor threateningly. They stop 10 paces from us, enough, perhaps they think, to be able to escape Achilles if he were to lose his temper. I indulge myself in vicious images, Achilles leaping up to snap their necks, leaving them limp as dead rabbits in a hunter's hand. They stutter out a greeting, feet shifting, eyes down. Then,
we have come to take custody of the girl.
Achilles answers them, cold and bitter, but wryly so, his anger banked and shielded. He is giving a show, I know, of grace and tolerance, and my teeth clench at the calmness in his tone. He likes this image of himself, the wronged young man, stoically accepting the theft of his prize, a martyrdom for the whole camp to see. I hear my name and see them looking at me. I am to get Briseis. She is waiting for me. Her hands are empty. She is taking nothing with her.
I'm sorry, I whisper.
She does not say it is all right. It is not. She leans forward and I can smell the warm sweetness of her breath. Her lips graze mine. Then she steps past me and is gone. Talthybius takes one side of her, Eurybates the other. Their fingers press, not gently, into the skin of her arm. They tow her forward, eager to be away from us. She is forced to move or fall. Her head turns back to look at us, and I want to break at the desperate hope in her eyes. I stare at him, will him to look up, to change his mind. He does not. They are out of our camp now, moving quickly. After a moment, I can barely distinguish them from the other dark figures that move against the sand, eating and walking and gossiping intently about their feuding kings. Anger sweeps through me like brush fire.
How can you let her go? I ask, my teeth hard against one another.
His face is blank and barren, like another language, impenetrable. He says,
I must speak with my mother.
Go then, I snarl. I watch him leave. My stomach feels burned to cinders. My palms ache where my nails have cut into them. I do not know this man, I think. He is no one I have ever seen before. My rage towards him is hot as blood. I will never forgive him. I imagine tearing down our tent, smashing the lyre, stabbing myself in the stomach and bleeding to death. I want to see his face broken with grief and regret. I want to shatter the cold mask of stone that has slipped down over the boy I knew. He has given her to Agamemnon, knowing what will happen. Now he expects that I will wait here, impotent and obedient. I have nothing to offer Agamemnon for her safety. I cannot bribe him, and I cannot beg him. The king of Mycenae has waited too long for this triumph. He will not let her go. I think of a wolf guarding its bone. There were such wolves on Pelion, who would hunt men if they were hungry enough.
If one of them is stalking you, Chiron said, you must give it something it wants more than you.
There is only one thing that Agamemnon wants more than Briseis. I yank the knife from my belt. I have never liked blood, but there is no help for that now. The guards see me belatedly and are too surprised to lift their weapons. One has the presence of mind to seize me, but I dig my nails into his arm and he lets go. Their faces are slow and stupid with shock. Am I not just Achilles' pet rabbit? If I were a warrior, they would fight me, but I am not. By the time they think they should restrain me, I am inside the tent. The first thing I see is Briseis. Her hands have been tied, and she is shrinking in a corner. Agamemnon stands with his back to the entrance, speaking to her. He turns, scowling at the interruption. But when he sees me, his face goes slick with triumph. I have come to beg, he thinks. I am here to plead for mercy, as Achilles' ambassador. Or perhaps I will rage impotently for his entertainment. I lift the knife, and Agamemnon's eyes widen. His hand goes to the knife at his own belt, and his mouth opens to call the guards. He does not have time to speak. I slash the knife down at my left wrist. It scores the skin but does not bite deep enough. I slash again, and this time I find the vein. Blood spurts in the enclosed space. I hear Briseis's noise of horror. Agamemnon's face is spattered with drops. I swear that the news I bring is truth, I say. I swear it on my blood. Agamemnon is taken aback. The blood and the oath stay his hand. He has always been superstitious.
Well, he says curtly, trying for dignity. Speak your news, then.
I can feel the blood draining down my wrist, but I do not move to stanch it. You are in the gravest danger, I say. He sneers.
Are you threatening me? Is this why he has sent you?
No, he has not sent me at all. His eyes narrow, and I see his mind working, fitting tiles into the picture.
Surely you come with his blessing.
No, I say. He is listening now. He knows what you intend towards the girl, I say. Out of the corner of my eye, I can see Briseis following our conversation, but I do not dare to look at her directly. My wrist throbs dully, and I can feel the warm blood filling my hand, then emptying again. I drop the knife and press my thumb onto the vein to slow the steady draining of my heart.
And?
Do you not wonder why he did not prevent you from taking her? My voice is disdainful. He could have killed your men and all your army. Do you not think he could have held you off? Agamemnon's face is red, but I do not allow him to speak. He let you take her. He knows you will not resist bedding her, and this will be your downfall. She is his, won through fair service. The men will turn on you if you violate her, and the gods as well. I speak slowly, deliberately, and the words land like arrows, each in its target. It is true what I say, though he has been too blinded by pride and lust to see it. She is in Agamemnon's custody, but she is Achilles' prize still. To violate her is a violation of Achilles himself, the gravest insult to his honor. Achilles could kill him for it, and even Menelaus would call it fair. You are at your power's limit even in taking her. The men allowed it because he was too proud, but they will not allow more. We obey our kings, but only within reason. If Aristos Achaean's prize is not safe, none of ours are. Such a king will not be allowed to rule for long. Agamemnon has not thought of any of this. The realizations come like waves drowning him. Desperate, he says,
My counselors have said nothing of this.
Perhaps they do not know what you intend, or perhaps it serves their own purposes. I pause to let him consider this. Who will rule if you fall? He knows the answer. Odysseus and Diomedes together, with Menelaus as figurehead. He begins to understand at last the size of the gift I have brought him. He has not come so far by being a fool.
You betray him by warning me.
It is true. Achilles has given Agamemnon a sword to fall upon, and I have stayed his hand. The words are thick and bitter. I do.
Why?
He asks. Because he is wrong, I say. My throat feels raw and broken, as though I have drunk sand and salt. Agamemnon considers me. I am known for my honesty, for my kind-heartedness. There is no reason to disbelieve me. He smiles.
You have done well, he says. You show yourself loyal to your true master.
He pauses, savoring this, storing it up.
Does he know what you have done?
Not yet, I say.
Ah.
His eyes half close, imagining it. I watch the bolt of his triumph sliding home. He is a connoisseur of pain. There is nothing that could cause Achilles greater anguish than this, being betrayed to his worst enemy by the man he holds closest to his heart.
If he will come and kneel for pardon, I swear I will release her. It is only his own pride that keeps his honor from him, not I. Tell him.
I do not answer. I stand and walk to Briseis. I cut the rope that binds her. Her eyes are full. She knows what this has cost me.
Your wrist,
she whispers. I cannot answer her. My head is a confusion of triumph and despair. The sand of the tent is red with my blood. Treat her well, I say. I turn and leave. She will be all right now, I tell myself. He is feasting fat on the gift I have given him. I tear a strip from my tunic to bind my wrist. I am dizzy, though I do not know if it is with loss of blood or what I have done. Slowly, I begin the long walk back up the beach. He is standing outside the tent when I return. His tunic is damp from where he knelt in the sea. His face is wrapped closed, but there is a weariness to its edges. Like fraying cloth, it matches mine.
Where have you been?
In the camp. I am not ready yet to tell him. How is your mother?
She is well. You are bleeding.
The bandage has soaked through. I know, I say.
Let me look at it.
I follow him obediently into the tent. He takes my arm and unwraps the cloth. He brings water to rinse the wound clean and packs it with crushed yarrow and honey.
A knife? He asks.
Yes. We know the storm is coming. We are waiting as long as we can. He binds the wound with clean bandages. He brings me watered wine and food as well. I can tell by his face that I look ill and pale.
Will you tell me who hurt you?
I imagine saying, you, but that is nothing more than childishness. I did it to myself.
Why?
For an oath. There is no waiting any longer. I look at him, full in the face. I went to Agamemnon. I told him of your plan.
My plan?
His words are flat, almost detached. To let him rape Briseis, so that you might revenge yourself on him. Saying it out loud is more shocking than I thought it would be. He rises, half turning so I cannot see his face. I read his shoulders instead, their set, the tension of his neck.
So you warned him?
I did.
You know, if he had done it, I could have killed him.
That same flat tone.
Or exiled him, forced him from the throne. The men would have honored me like a god.
I know, I say. There is a silence, a dangerous one. I keep waiting for him to turn on me, to scream or strike out. And he does turn, to face me at last.
her safety, for my honor. Are you happy with your trade?
There is no honor in betraying your friends.
It is strange, he says, that you would speak against betrayal.
There is more pain in those words almost than I can bear. I force myself to think of Briseis. It was the only way.
You chose her, he says, over me.
Over your pride. The word I use is hubris, our word for arrogance that scrapes the stars, for violence and towering rage as ugly as the gods. His fists tighten. Now, perhaps, the attack will come.
My life is my reputation, he says.
His breath sounds ragged.
It is all I have. I will not live much longer. Memory is all I can hope for.
He swallows thickly.
You know this. And would you let Agamemnon destroy it? Would you help him take it from me?
I would not, I say. But I would have the memory be worthy of the man. I would have you be yourself, not some tyrant remembered for his cruelty. There are other ways to make Agamemnon pay. We will do it. I will help you, I swear. But not like this. No fame is worth what you did today.
He turns away again and is silent.
I stare at his unspeaking back. I memorize each fold in his tunic, each bit of drying salt and sand stuck to his skin. When he speaks at last, his voice is weary and defeated. He doesn't know how to be angry with me either. We are like damp wood that won't light.
It is done then. She is safe. She must be. You would not have come back otherwise.
Yes, she is safe. A tired breath.
You are a better man than I.
The beginning of hope. We have given each other wounds, but they are not mortal. Briseis will not be harmed, and Achilles will remember himself, and my wrist will heal. There will be a moment after this, and another after that. No, I say. I stand and walk to him. I put my hand to the warmth of his skin. It is not true. You left yourself today, and now you are returned. His shoulders rise and fall on a long breath.
Do not say that, he says, until you have heard the rest of what I have done.
Chapter 27. There are three small stones on the rugs of our tent, kicked in by our feet or crept in on their own. I pick them up. They are something to hold on to. His weariness has faded as he speaks.
I will fight for him no longer. At every turn he seeks to rob me of my rightful glory, to cast me into shadow and doubt. He cannot bear another man to be honored over him, but he will learn. I will show him the worth of his army without Aristos Achaean.
I do not speak. I can see the temper rising in him. It is like watching a storm come when there is no shelter.
The Greeks will fall without me to defend them. He will be forced to beg or die.
I remember how he looked when he went to see his mother, wild, fevered, hard as granite. I imagine him kneeling before her, weeping with rage, beating his fists on the jagged sea rocks. They have insulted him, he says to her. They have dishonored him. They have ruined his immortal reputation. She listens, her fingers pulling absently on her long white throat, supple as a seal, and begins to nod. She has an idea, a god's idea, full of vengeance and wrath. She tells him, and his weeping stops.
He will do it?
Achilles asks in wonder. He means Zeus, king of the gods, whose head is wreathed in clouds, whose hands can hold the thunderbolt itself.
He will do it,
Thetis says.
He is in my debt.
Zeus, the great balancer, will let go his scales. He will make the Greeks lose and lose and lose until they are crushed against the sea, anchors and ropes tangling their feet, masts and prows splintering on their backs, and then they will see who they must beg for. Thetis leans forward and kisses her son, a bright starfish of red, high on his cheek, Then she turns and is gone, slipped into the water like a